It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. As European settlers and homesteaders moved west in the United States, their progress was marked in part by wholesale slaughter of wildlife. Wildlife was so plentiful that very few people could imagine that a whole species could ever be wiped out. But then it started to happen, and some people started to push back. This hour will mark the centennial of the Migratory Bird Treaty, which saved many species from extinction. And with me is renowned ornithologist and biologist Stan Temple. He is the Beers Bascom Professor Emeritus in Conservation at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Senior Fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation. He'll also be in Iowa next week speaking at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History on Thursday, September 15th from 6 to 8 p.m. It's a celebration of the centennial of the Migratory Bird Treaty sponsored by the Iowa Raptor Project. Stan Temple, welcome back to Talk of Iowa.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And let's go back in time to around the turn of the 20th century. Paint for me a picture of the state of birds during that time.
Well, it was an interesting time in our relationship with wildlife and other natural resources. We were coming out of that frontier era in which no one really thought much about the limitations on the natural resources of the country, whether it was forests or wildlife or other resources. And it was a period in which that problem of not giving much thought to it led to really terrible over-exploitation without any sort of serious regulation of our behavior. And during this period of time, we ended up threatening a number of species with extinction. Some of them were birds and mammals that people didn't really know that much about. There were things like the great auks and the Labrador ducks that were not common knowledge to most people. But the species that really snapped people to attention was the passenger pigeon. The passenger pigeon was, at the early part of the 19th century, the most abundant bird in North America and arguably the most abundant bird in the world.
Well, and I think people today probably, I know I can't even imagine the abundance of the passenger pigeon, which was quite different from the pigeons that live with us in cities. But give us just an idea of what a flock of passenger pigeons would have looked like at the height of their abundance.
Well, fortunately, we have several good accounts, one by the famous bird artist John James Audubon, in which he encountered a large flock of passenger pigeons that flew overhead and literally darkened the sky for 2 days on end. And in the face of that type of superabundance, you can easily imagine how people were lulled into a sense of complacency about the scale at which they were exploiting passenger pigeons. It's no exaggeration to say that during the 19th century, virtually everyone in the eastern United States ate passenger pigeon. It was a standard fare that just about everyone participated in exploiting and eating.
And the fact that this bird that could blacken out the sky was disappearing, I mean, that really was the main wake-up call for people who started to question this kind of action, right?
It really was a wake-up call, and it went through a very typical sort of progression of people's awareness of the problem. At first, there was denial that this could possibly be happening, and all kinds of excuses were offered on why it couldn't be happening, but eventually came to the realization that by 1900, there were very few individual birds left in the wild, and by 1902, the very last wild passenger pigeon was killed in Indiana. And then in 1914, the very last individual, a bird named Martha, died in captivity at the Cincinnati Zoo. But the history of the passenger pigeon during the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th century was essentially a microcosm of what was happening to many other species.
Now, I want to talk about an individual who did advocate for change. And, of course, Iowans who know about him are very proud of Representative John Lacey, who really introduced what would become the first federal wildlife protection law. That was the Lacey Act, passed in 1900. What was he trying to do?
Well, John Lacey really was part of that first wave of individuals who were trying to introduce policies and legislation that would deal with this over-exploitation of wildlife. And what he tried to do with the Lacey Act was to, as he described it, break the back of the market hunters. You have to remember, at this time, it was a commercial exploitation of wildlife. This wasn't individuals going out. This was a major industry, a business. And the Lacey Act in 1900, he thought that one way to, as he said, break the back of the market hunters was to deny them the access to markets by imposing federal regulations on the interstate transportation of wildlife. It was a beginning. It was the very first federal action to try to protect wildlife, and it ushered in an era of what is often referred to as protectionism, where people were really focused, almost obsessively focused on the idea of protecting wildlife species from direct killing by human beings. And the Lacey Act was just the opening round, you might say. Today we think of the Lacey Act as being the federal regulation that covers interstate commerce, but its original intent was to do that as a way to basically cripple the ability of these commercial market hunters to exploit wildlife.
After the Lacey Act passed, I mean, as you said, it sort of was a catalyst that gave voice to a movement that maybe had already been growing. What didn't it do? Because obviously, as the Migratory Bird Treaty came several years later, it wasn't enough, right?
Well, no, it was focused on a very specific problem that was a huge problem at that time, and that was the fact that people were directly killing birds and other wildlife species, and therefore the logic was, if that's why species like the passenger pigeon were becoming extinct, why the American bison was virtually wiped out, if that was the problem, we need to protect these animals from direct harm. But it was very sharply focused on that single problem, you might say, and it didn't address any of the other types of problems that wildlife would eventually be facing.
And what did the Migratory Bird Treaty, the Bird Act, do when it finally came about?
Well, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act is kind of an interesting history, if you will. It was preceded by several other attempts to protect migratory birds. Probably the most notable and the one that many people will today be familiar with was Teddy Roosevelt. President Teddy Roosevelt in 1903 created the first wildlife refuge. Today, of course, we have an extensive system of national wildlife refuges. But again, that was one of the early actions, in this case, to protect places where migratory birds wouldn't be hunted and wouldn't be killed. But in terms of real direct federal legislation, in 1913, the Migratory Bird Act was passed, And it was, for the first time, it gave the federal government a role in protecting migratory birds. And it was, again, part of that reaction to the overkill of the 19th century. And it was interesting that the Migratory Bird Act of 1913, it didn't last very long. It only lasted a couple of months because two federal courts quickly ruled that it was unconstitutional because they interpreted it as the federal government usurping authorities that the states felt that they had. So it became a state's right issue rather than a bird protection act. But the failure of that Migratory Bird Act in 1913, that is what catalyzed the thought about how do we get around this obstacle of state rights and individual states claiming that they had authority over wildlife. And the discussions at the time eventually coalesced around a continental scale solution, and that was to sort of do an end run, you might say, and enter into a treaty with Great Britain, who at the time, of course, was the official sort of authority for Canada. But the Migratory Bird Treaty of 1918 was essentially a way to get around the problem of state rights, because if the U.S., through the executive branch, entered into a treaty with Canada and Great Britain, it sort of did an end run around Congress, and it allowed Congress then to sort of follow suit and say, well, okay, we've entered into this official international treaty, we have to now follow through and ratify it and implement our
We'll talk more about what that did in just a moment. I'm talking with renowned ornithologist and biologist Stan Temple. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're marking the centennial of the Migratory Bird Treaty, which paved the way for protecting many species in the United States and elsewhere, species that were threatened by a lack of regulation about who could hunt what species when. With me this hour is renowned ornithologist and biologist Stan Temple. He's also the Beers Bascom Professor Emeritus in Conservation at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Senior Fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation. He will be in Iowa next week, speaking at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History on Thursday, September 15th from 6 to 8 p.m. It's a celebration of the centennial of the Migratory Bird Treaty, sponsored by the Iowa Raptor Project. And just before the break, we were talking about how in creating a treaty with the Great Britain and Canada, that made it possible, sort of did an end run around Congress where there were problems and an end run around people who were complaining about states' rights, and really made it possible to protect some of these species. I'm sure some people, when they hear about the Migratory Bird Treaty, think, why just migratory birds? I mean, did this really protect all the species that were in danger at that point?
Well, it's an interesting point that it is the Migratory Bird Treaty, and it only covered species of birds that migrate between Canada and the U.S. All of the other bird species of the U.S. that don't cross the border were left under state control. So this was the federal government basically carving out a group of birds, migratory birds, that moved between Canada and the U.S. that clearly needed to have some uniform type of protection, because obviously these birds move around and it was impossible for individual states to properly manage and conserve them. You really have to do it on a continental scale. So it was an important sort of ecological, biological realization that was incorporated into the strategy for protecting these birds. But it did reflect essentially the mindset, the paradigm, if you will, of the day, and that was that it once again only dealt with the problem of people directly killing birds. It did not address any other type of issue. So it was very focused, once again, on this issue of people exploiting birds, killing them for meat, for feathers, for other types of products.
And, of course, we know that one of the things that was really threatening these species and many others at that time, as it is today, is habitat destruction. When did awareness of that begin to grow? Because, of course, as we had settled this country, changing the environment, conquering the land was part of what people did.
Well, that's true. And at least for a while, it was not a major threat to birds. We weren't converting habitat on a large enough scale that it was apparent to most people that this would eventually become a threat to species. It wasn't really until a couple of decades after the Migratory Bird Treaty that the shortcomings of the treaty started to become apparent, and that was that the types of threats to birds had expanded, and the Migratory Bird Treaty just wasn't up to the task of, for example, protecting habitat from destruction. So it was another Iowan, actually, who was one of the individuals who sort of sounded the alarm, and that was Aldo Leopold. Native son of
Burlington, Iowa, and of course spent much of his life in Wisconsin, where you have spent much of your life as well. And so Aldo Leopold was one of the leaders of really that new conservation movement.
He was, and he started talking about the shortcomings of just protecting wildlife from direct killing. He started talking about this as early as the 1920s, and in the 1930s, he really sort of boldly moved forward and introduced a new paradigm, if you will, a new way of looking at the problem of wildlife conservation that today we call wildlife management, in contrast to wildlife protection. And there are several things that people will be familiar with that changed because of Aldo Leopold's pioneering work in the 20s and 30s. Up to that point, if you were in any way employed or engaged in wildlife conservation, you were likely to have had a title game warden. You were there to enforce laws like the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. You were there to protect birds or wildlife from direct harm by people. Aldo Leopold, with this new approach, said, no, that's not enough. We need to be paying attention to the habitat needs of wildlife. And he introduced, of course, what today we call wildlife management. So today, people who are engaged, there are still game wardens who enforce hunting laws, essentially, but there is also a larger group of wildlife managers who look after, pay attention to all of these other threats that human beings pose to wildlife.
Now, of course, over time, with new conservation methods, with this understanding of biology and ecology that was growing, some of these species really have bounced back without much interference from human beings. And we've seen, even just in recent years, in the last 10 years, some populations that have really grown and returned and become much more visible than they were for many, many years. But there are other species that needed a lot more help. And of course, there were other things that we were doing that were threatening these species. And one of the main things was pesticide application. DDT, of course, that story is one that has been talked about many, many times, but that was certainly a problem that was putting a number of migratory bird species, especially raptors, at risk of disappearing altogether in spite of being protected, right?
That's right, and it certainly illustrated the shortfall of the Migratory Bird Treaty and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that enabled it, and that was that it simply did not deal with all of these indirect and sometimes inadvertent ways that we threaten wildlife. The Migratory Bird Treaty was focused on very deliberate and direct killing of birds. So when you look at the problems that face wildlife and birds during the 20th century, certainly overkill is still a problem for some species, but we have a whole host of new problems like habitat loss. We've got ecosystem stress that comes largely from pollution. We introduce lots of exotic species that end up threatening native species. In other words, there's this big constellation of threats now that don't seem to be adequately covered by the Migratory Bird Treaty. So we've had to sort of expand the ways that we focus our conservation efforts on birds.
I want to talk about some of the work that you did after DDT was banned, you and a number of others who were involved in bringing the peregrine falcon back from the brink of extinction. And you and others realized that, again, this was not enough to protect this species, but something else had to be done to intervene and make sure that they could breed and actually be reintroduced to the environment that they had lived in before and other environments as well. Tell me a little bit about this particular species and the problem that you saw that led you to take some really interesting action.
Well, the peregrine falcon did become one of the sort of poster birds, you might say, for the problem that pesticides like DDT were causing for birds. And part of that was because the peregrine falcon is somewhat unique in that it's one of just a handful of bird species that's found everywhere in the world. And peregrine falcons declined precipitously after World War II everywhere in the world. So it was a massive global decline of this once widespread and common species. And it took a little while to figure out what the problem was, but eventually the culprit did emerge as DDT and other similar pesticides that were concentrated in the peregrine falcon's food chain and eventually resulted in peregrine falcons getting a high enough concentration of DDT that it disrupted their physiology. They laid thin-shelled eggs that cracked before they could hatch. And you don't need to have a PhD in biology to understand if a species can't reproduce successfully, its extinction becomes a mathematical certainty. So there was great concern that the peregrine falcon was going to go extinct. It was listed as an endangered species, and it wasn't really until the early 1970s, after peregrine falcons were gone from more than half of North America, that we finally got around to banning DDT. We did it first here in Wisconsin at the state level and followed up then at the national level. And that paved the way then for people to start thinking about a recovery of the peregrine falcon. And one of those individuals was my major professor when I was a graduate student at Cornell, named Tom Cade. He had a vision that we could breed peregrine falcons in captivity and then reintroduce the birds that had been produced in captivity back into the large vacant areas where peregrine falcons no longer existed.
And that was that a controversial idea at that time? Because breeding animals in captivity to be released into the wild is problematic on a lot of levels. With birds in particular, there is an imprinting that happens shortly after they hatch out of their egg. So if they don't see another one of their species, they may not really understand what they are.
Well, there are lots of problems, of course, with captive breeding, and no one had really bred peregrine falcons before, so there were no end of critics who basically scoffed at the idea and said, you know, this is a pipe dream. You'll never be able to do it. And indeed, it was difficult getting started. It was hard assembling enough birds. And part of the problem, as you just suggested, was that a lot of the peregrine falcons that were available were birds that had been owned by falconers. And many of these birds had been taken from the nest when they were young, and they did become imprinted on their human handlers. Imprinting is a process whereby young animals, if you might say, learn their identity, both socially and sexually. And these birds that we first had access to were often incapable of mating with their own species, and instead they were much more interested in bonding with human beings. And this is where I sort of entered the picture with an idea. I was a falconer, have been a falconer all my life, and had a male red-tailed hawk that was imprinted on me. And it struck me that, you know, these birds might not be a total loss to captive breeding if we could find some way to use their sort of misbehavior in a way that would produce offspring. And the idea was basically to take an imprinted male and an imprinted female that wouldn't have anything to do with one another, and for the human handler to do artificial insemination. So I had a male bird, a male red-tailed hawk, that was sexually interested only in human beings, and it turns out that an Iowan, Joe Price, had...
A well-known blues musician here in Iowa who also happened to be a falconer.
Right, and Joe had an imprinted female. So Joe generously allowed me to borrow his female.
I just want to clarify, because you were in New York State?
I was in New York at Cornell University, right.
All right, and he was in Iowa. Were red-tailed hawks that hard to come by?
No, they weren't that hard to come by, but to have Joe Price's imprinted female who would lay eggs for him, that was just what we needed at the time.
So how did she travel from Iowa to Ithaca?
Well, falconers transport their birds around all the time, so she rode from Iowa to Ithaca, New York, in a car. But the two birds, my male, a male named Argus, and Joe Price's female named Drifter, they became the parents, via artificial insemination, of the first young bird to be produced in this way. And it led to something of a little breakthrough, you might say, for zoos and other institutions that were trying to breed endangered species. One of my fellow graduate students at the time, for example, was George Archibald, who is now somewhat famous as the founder of the International Crane Foundation here in Wisconsin. And he was having an interesting time discovering that many of the cranes, endangered cranes that zoos had, were imprinted. So taking a lead from what we were doing with hawks and falcons, George Archibald did the same thing with cranes.
And being able to do this with the red-tailed hawk, which was not an endangered
species,
it would have been very problematic to do sort of experimentation on an endangered species.
But it did pave the way for doing artificial insemination with many other endangered species.
And when these birds did reproduce, when Joe's falcon Drifter, or red-tailed hawk Drifter, laid an egg, was she interested in incubating the egg and caring for the offspring?
Actually, she would have if we had let her, and she subsequently in subsequent years did, but the first go-round, we put the egg into an incubator and incubated it.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll talk more about how Drifter paved the way, but also how peregrine falcons made a recovery and some of the other species that were cared for in similar ways that have made a recovery. We'll also talk about some of the things today that are still threatening bird species in the United States. With me is renowned ornithologist and biologist Stan Temple. He'll be in Iowa next week speaking at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History in Iowa City, of course, on Thursday, September 15th from 6 to 8 p.m. This event is open to the public. It's a celebration of the centennial of the Migratory Bird Treaty, and it's sponsored by the Iowa Raptor Project. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are marking the centennial of the Migratory Bird Treaty, which saved many species from extinction and paved the way for the major conservation movement of the 20th century. With me this hour is ornithologist and biologist Stan Temple. He's the Beers Bascom Professor Emeritus of Conservation at the University of Iowa, or University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's also Senior Fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation. He'll be giving a program in Iowa City on Thursday, September 15th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History, a celebration of the centennial of the Migratory Bird Treaty. And before the break, we were talking about the groundbreaking work that you did in artificial insemination in raptors, including an Iowan raptor, a red-tailed hawk named Drifter, and you had success with that. That paved the way for using that as a method to breed endangered species in captivity. And as that progressed, I mean, you were breeding peregrine falcons in captivity. And I asked just before the break whether Drifter would have raised the offspring that she produced. Did you have peregrine falcons that were imprinted on humans in captivity that could raise their own offspring?
Oh, yes, we did. And indeed, the imprinting problem does not interfere with these birds being capable of raising their own offspring.
Okay, so the parent would not have been successfully able to live in the wild because of the imprinting, but they could raise offspring that could successfully live in the wild.
Exactly. And, of course, once we started the captive breeding program at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, it took a while to sort of gather some steam, you might say, and be capable of producing a large enough number of young peregrines that we could even experiment with reintroducing them to the wild. And once again, there were a fair number of critics who said, you know, well, okay, you managed to breed them in captivity, but you'll never be able to get these birds to adapt back to the wild. So we started the very first experiment doing this in 1975, and I guess you could say things worked splendidly. Everything went really according to schedule. We took the young birds that had been produced in captivity. We took them out into the wild and released them at sites around the eastern U.S., and they not only survived, they not only thrived, but in the following years they came back and established territories. And eventually, as we released more and more birds, they were able to find one another out there and started breeding. And, of course, the rest, as they say, is history. And in literally in 20 years, we had reached the point where the peregrine falcon could come off the endangered list and could really once again thrive in the United States.
The peregrine falcon story is such an incredible story of recovery and creativity, both in using artificial insemination, but also in introducing peregrine falcons in places that we didn't necessarily think they could live, including high-rise buildings in big cities, since cliffs were a little harder to come by than they once were. And we should spend a lot more time on another program talking about that. But with these great success stories, with these species coming back, with a greater understanding on the part of biologists, lawmakers, and the public, what do you feel are the greatest threats to bird species today?
Well, you could address that in several ways, and given that we started our conversation with the Migratory Bird Treaty, one way to look at this is how are human beings killing birds today? And if we look at the human-caused sources of bird mortality as one of the problems that that they face, in addition to things like habitat loss, an interesting research project was done just in the last few years by the U.S. Government and the Canadian government looking at sources of bird mortality. And for those who are familiar with bird conservation issues, it was perhaps not a surprise that the biggest source of human-associated or human-caused bird mortality was cats. Cats, of course, are a human artifact. They don't belong in North America naturally, but cats that are allowed to free range and kill birds were the biggest source of human-caused mortality, followed by collisions with buildings, with automobiles, with all kinds of other human-made structures that we've put out there in the environment.
And let's talk a little bit more about cats before we moved on, because I think that's a really shocking fact that they are the biggest source of human-caused mortality.
It is for most people, and there's, I guess you could say, again, a lot of denial about the magnitude of the problem. But the study that was done by biologists at the Smithsonian Institution, as well as a parallel study in Canada, showed that in the U.S. alone, it's over 2 billion birds that are killed by free-ranging cats every year. And that's far more, for example, than some of the other sources of human-caused mortality that people often imagine are causing sort of large-scale mortality of birds. So, you know, agricultural chemicals poisoning birds or birds running into wind turbines, these are really small scale problems in terms of bird mortality in comparison to something as ubiquitous as free-ranging cats.
Let's talk about some of the other environmental things that may be threatening birds, because, of course, DDT was banned years ago, although anybody who's spent much time studying a mass spectrometer can tell you that it still shows up today in species that are found dead and still shows up in the environment. What other kinds of leftovers do we still have in our environment, even if we're aware of the problem now and maybe not putting more into the environment? What are some of the other chemicals or other pollutants that are really threatening species?
Well, we have addressed some of the worst that caused the very, you know, large-scale declines of predatory birds like bald eagles and peregrine falcons and so forth. But there are still sources of poisoning of birds that do cause problems. One here in the Midwest is lead poisoning. Lead poisoning was recognized as a major source of mortality for waterfowl. We banned lead shot for hunting waterfowl as a result of that threat. But today, for example, lead poisoning is one of the principal sources of human-caused mortality for common loons, a bird that many people really care a lot about. There's a lot of pollution out there that results essentially from the fossil fuel industry, oil spills and oil waste pits that kill large numbers of birds. And we're all familiar with those sort of pitiful photographs of birds being picked up, covered in oil. So the problems of poisoning or pollution causing mortality of birds, whether it's lead poisoning or mercury poisoning or oil spills, it's still out there. We still kill birds because of environmental pollution. But again, those are relatively minor problems compared to some of the big threats to birds that aren't necessarily causing direct mortality, but affect a lot of birds, like habitat loss.
So what are your priorities? What would you like to see individuals and legislators really focusing on right now?
Well, I think right now, because we're celebrating the centenary of the Migratory Bird Treaty, I think the immediate thing that people who care about bird conservation could pay attention to is the fact that the Migratory Bird Treaty and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that enables it, they're 100 years old, and they need to be tweaked to bring them up to 21st century standards. And there are a number of things that are likely, I would say, to happen in the next few years. Some of them could be positive in that they could strengthen the protection for migratory birds by addressing some of these more or less inadvertent ways that we kill birds. But there's also threats to the Migratory Bird Treaty. Special interest groups who've been inconvenienced by having to avoid killing birds are lobbying hard to have the Migratory Bird Treaty actually weakened so that they would not be liable for inadvertently killing birds. So the next few years are going to be interesting. And in 2018, we have the 100th anniversary of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the actual piece of legislation that Congress passed that is the actual law that protects birds formally in the U.S. So it's great to celebrate the Migratory Bird Treaty, you know, now in 2016, but between now and 2018, there's still some work to be done to make sure that the protection for migratory birds is up to the challenges of the 21st century.
Now, in addition to being a scientist and an advocate for protection of these species and doing all the work that you've done, you're also a person who just really loves nature and loves being out in nature, and that's something that you developed as a young child. You've written about a really surprising relationship that you had with somebody that everyone knows as really one of the mothers of the modern environmental movement, and that's Rachel Carson. But not as a mentor, as an ecologist, or not a mentor as a political activist. She was a mentor of yours in another way. Can you just briefly tell me a little bit about your relationship with her?
As a very young boy in the early 1950s, I was interested in nature, and my mother would let me attend field trips sponsored by the local Audubon Society in Washington, D.C., and on those field trips, I was sort of adopted by this middle-aged woman who took quite an interest in encouraging my interest in birds. I knew her at that time only as Miss Carson, but I subsequently learned that she was Rachel Carson, who even in the early 1950s, long before she became famous for Silent Spring, she was a very well-known nature writer. One of the very first nature films that was ever made was based on one of her books. But she was a wonderful person in that she introduced me as an 8-year-old boy, not so much to learning facts about nature as learning to love and appreciate nature. It was, of course, many years later that she became the iconic figure for the emergence of the modern environmental movement. But for me, at least, she was one of my sort of childhood mentors, you might say, that really cemented my interest in nature.
With how much our culture has changed for a lot of kids today, ecology is an academic subject, something that they learn about in school, if they learn about it at all, not something that they learn by going out and playing and getting their hands dirty. Does that worry you?
Well, it does. And Richard Louv, the author, described it as nature deficit disorder. a problem that results from young people growing up essentially at that critical age in their childhood without having real experiences in the out-of-doors. And those people, perhaps somewhat predictably, are less interested and concerned about the environment and are not willing to go out of their way to protect it. So those type of early childhood outdoor experiences are very important, not only for people who, like myself, go on to careers in conservation, but just for the average citizen who gains their understanding and concern for the environment as a result of those early experiences.
Do you feel like maybe as educators and even parents, we focus a little bit too much on facts and challenges such as global warming or endangered species, as opposed to helping kids really awaken that sense of wonder?
I think there is a potential problem that young people, if they're made aware of all of the problems that exist in the world, that it sort of cultivates a feeling of helplessness, that there's nothing that I can do to change the course of events. So, indeed, you know, modern environmental education that has emerged essentially since Rachel Carson's 1960s book, Silent Spring, you know, often is trying very hard to give young people that exposure to nature. But at the same time, young kids are very aware of all the problems that exist in the world.
Just looking at what you've accomplished in your career, though, I mean, even just focusing on the peregrine falcon, that's such a success story. That does give us an idea of what an individual or a small group of individuals can do to affect positive change.
Absolutely, and that's how just about everything happens, is passionate individuals doing something about an issue that they're concerned about. And we know that bird watchers, people who are concerned about birds, are a very large and potentially powerful influence, you might say, on government, just as they were 100 years ago with the Migratory Bird Treaty. They need to once again exert their sort of power to protect birds.
Stan Temple, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome.
Stan Temple is a renowned ornithologist and biologist. He's the Beers Bascom Professor Emeritus in Conservation at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Senior Fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation. He will be in Iowa City next week, Thursday, September 15th. He'll be giving a talk at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History from 6 to 8 p.m. It's a celebration of the centennial of the Migratory Bird Treaty, sponsored by the Iowa Raptor Project. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.